WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hey there, listeners. Every Sunday through the midterm elections in November, my friend from the WNYC and Gothamist newsroom, Bridget Bergen, will be hosting a call-in show that explores the power dynamics of New York's political landscape. And every Sunday, you can hear the podcast of that show here. So now, this week's edition of The People's Guide to Power.
This is The People's Guide to Power. I'm your host, Bridget Bergen, a senior reporter in the WNYC and Gothamist newsroom. This is our midterm election series that brings people with power together with those who seek it, the journalists that cover it, and you. Today, we're talking about redistricting. That's, of course, the process that takes place every 10 years to redraw election district lines based on current population numbers. It helps chart who will have electoral power for a decade, and that has lots of real-life implications for all of us. Specifically, where does the money flow, and do your representatives feel obligated to show up when your community has a problem? So to prepare for this week's show and to help lay out exactly what's at stake here, I spoke to a bunch of people who are working intimately on these issues, and here's what they had to say. Starting with Lucia Gomez, a redistricting advisor to Latino Justice, a civil rights advocacy organization.
Redistricting is the starting point, right? How you shape the district and how it moves post-redistricting, right? How the electorate can coalesce is what this this process is really about.
In other words, is your community fairly represented? Some advocates say badly drawn districts, ones that dilute the power of a community, act as a form of voter suppression. And then, of course, there are the partisan battles. I'm talking gerrymandering. In the last decade, partisan gerrymandering has tended to benefit Republicans across the country. That's according to analysis from the Brennan Center for Justice. And with control of Congress at stake this November, how states draw their district lines is a key part of that fight. Here in New York, after a so-called independent redistricting commission failed to come up with congressional and state legislative maps that everyone could agree on, the state legislature, which is controlled by Democrats, drew their own. And Republicans objected. A court battle in a rural Republican-controlled county ensued, and after going all the way to the state's highest court, a special master was appointed to draw new state, Senate, and congressional lines. Here's Special Master Jonathan Service, a postdoctoral fellow from Carnegie Mellon University.
I think that in my role in New York, I think I brought a neutrality to the process. And I think that neutrality, I hope that neutrality, will have led to outcomes for New York voters that will serve them throughout the entire decade.
The entire decade. Until another census. Not everyone was so thrilled with the lines the special master drew.
My name is Senator Michael Gianaris. I'm the deputy leader of the New York State Senate, and I was also the co-chair of the Legislative Task Force on Reapportionment.
Now, he says redistricting in New York has been a mess going back more than a decade, and this year's independent commission, adopted by voters, was destined for failure since it was made up of equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans. When it comes to the work of the special master, Gianaris says the guy just didn't know enough about New York to get it right.
No offense to Mr. Service, but In a matter of a couple of short weeks, he was asked to do something for a state he has very limited knowledge about. So we ended up with lines that were quite arbitrary as it related to community. My own Senate district got split three different ways. There is one cohesive neighborhood in Western Queens called Asoria, which now resides in three different Senate districts.
And the maps didn't just cause chaos in Queens. Think of Manhattan, with Congress members Jerry Nadler and Carolyn Maloney drawn into the same district, running against each other. Maloney lost a seat she's held for three decades.
The special master took Upper West Side and Upper East Side, and we all laughed because nobody would do that. Well, guess what? Nobody would do that in New York City.
That's Lucia Gomez again, who says that Pittsburgh-based special master did something that those in the city's political class would never have dared.
But guess what he did? He said, you know, two active white voter bases, put them together. Let them duke it out. Why should we keep them separate as if they're some elite class? And the reality is that he did it. No one else would have done that to them.
So where does all of that leave us? Power has shifted, and all the lines are not even done being drawn yet. Right now, here in the city, another commission is working to redraw the lines for city council districts. And joining us to talk about that process and what's at stake for people across New York City is the chair of the New York City Districting Commission, Dennis Walcott. He's also president and CEO of the Queens Public Library, a former city schools chancellor, and a former deputy mayor for Michael Bloomberg. Chair Walcott, welcome back to WNYC. It's so great to have you with us.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's an honor to be here.
Before we get into how you are doing your work and what the process involves, can you just talk about why you think redistricting matters and what's at stake in terms of power?
Well, first thing, please call me Dennis. I'm not into titles. And to me, it's an important process because even in your lead-up piece, it talks about what will be in the next 10 years. And I think there is a specific role that we, the commission, have to play in that regard. And I think also is decided by the U.S. Constitution, Voting Rights Act. There are a number of variables and guardrails that we have to follow that I think will avoid some of the issues that were raised before. And so just for the audience, that there are 15 members who are part of this commission, three appointed by the Republican minority city council members, five appointed by the majority, and then seven appointed by the mayor. And quite frankly, we haven't really had any issues around politics at all. So I heard earlier in the introduction around political gerrymandering, that has never been a part of our discussion. We know there are political implications for what we do, but the big P of politics have never really come into our discussion. And our charge is really, how do we now fit an additional 630,000 new residents when the existing 51 city council districts, and then getting really into the weeds for a minute, whereas, say, the prior commission 10 years ago had what was called a 10% deviation, where the largest and the smallest population can range 10%. We had now a 5% deviation, and that law was signed by the governor in October, not just for New York City, but statewide. So those are the variables we have to deal with in putting together a map that we know that there will be people who will not be happy, but there will be people who are happy. And one other point that I think is really important, as you did the intro, we made a conscious decision early on to increase the number of public hearings that we had. And we wanted the feedback from the public. And that to us was an extremely important thing to do. So having done that, we were able to get a lot more input from the public, and we would go to 12:30 in the morning. We had extensive meetings all together between the actual meetings, between the submission of email requests and responses. We had over 9,600 responses to help us form our opinions as we moved forward.
So, Dennis, thank you for, for reducing the formality of our conversation. And thanks for setting up the trip into the weeds, which I love to take. But before we go there, I want to just, you know, pull back for a minute and help people who maybe aren't following this as closely as you and I are. You know, if there was a sort of summer song for politics here in New York, I would say it is redistricting, kind of the ever-present, maybe annoying at a certain point. It led to court battles, two summer primaries. You certainly couldn't talk about the congressional races in New York 10 or New York 12 without talking about redistricting. And as important as those congressional lines are, what makes this council process so important as well?
Well, I think, one, the consciousness raising as a result of what happened both at the state level and the congressional level, the special master, has increased the awareness of individuals and the public as far as the importance of redistricting. And I think with this, it really does go to your introduction as far as the impact it will have moving forward for 10 years as far as council representation, city council representation in communities, and those communities that may feel that with the release of our preliminary maps, it didn't respond to their particular needs. And then we took a look at that, and then having a specific guideline as far as how we have to follow certain steps. So I think all that is important as far as the shaping of the future direction of the allocation of dollars to the communities and what it means. And the other thing is, ideally, the goal is not to get in any type of litigation at all. And that's the ideal. So we have a responsibility, and there's a multi-step process with us as well. So we did the community meetings, then we released a preliminary draft. People had a response now to have reactions to the preliminary draft. We did more community meetings in all five boroughs, got feedback. And while we, the commission members, have not talked to political individuals directly, you know, our staff have met with city council delegations to get their feedback and reaction to the preliminary drafts. And we've been held at an arm's length so that would not influence us. And with our outstanding staff, you know, they share, you know, some of the dynamics and interactions along that line. And then we start to go into the very tedious, and as you said, in your world of enjoyment, of map making. And map making is not that easy. And so I truly empathize with those who have gone through it before. And we have one commission member who's been part of three. This represents his third New York City Council redistricting commission. Wow. And so, you know, we have people, we have a judge who's a part of it, a number of lawyers, we have a number of union people who are part of it, and people who are part of the five boroughs of New York City that give their input.
Dennis, I wonder if, just before we get into some of the specifics of the work you've done, some of the draft maps, just could you talk quickly about some of the criteria the commission must consider as it tries to draw these new lines? I know the population has increased, and you talked about that 5% deviation, but there's some other criteria that, you know, needs to be part of this calculation based on state and federal law, correct?
Right. So obviously with the U.S. Constitution, person, one person, one vote. In addition to that, we have the rights of the Voting Rights Act and the implications of that. I think, again, in the intro to the piece, as far as you can't dilute voters at all, especially in protected districts. And then also you have to take a look at the opportunities that are out there, because, again, in New York City, with the additional 630,000 people, those 630,000 people will represent increases of Hispanic population and the Asian American Pacific Islander population as well. So the voting rights implications as far as opportunity districts and what that means. So all of those are part of the guidelines that we have to follow. And then with that, we have to always make sure our lawyers are holding us really accountable as far as the specific pieces that we have a responsibility to adhere to. In addition to that, we have a voting rights expert who is part of the consultant team that really talks about racial block voting and doing an analysis along the issue of race and the voting patterns in New York City to make sure we adhere to that. So all of those are the things that go into our decision-making as far as those steps we have to follow. And it's an important thing. And then what we've done also, while not part of Allura, as part of how we operate and part of New York City, we made sure that in getting out to the communities, we went out both in local newspapers and language-specific newspapers, and made sure that people were aware of that. So between the Constitution, the Census, Voting Rights Act, and other variables, in addition to what I talked about before with the deviation, you have all those things going to fit together. And I say that because it's part of our requirement. It's part of our job to adhere to. So those are the guardrails I referred to earlier. Yeah. But with that, we know, at least I know, that it's not going to be a popularity contest either. When you're dealing with a city as large as 8.8 million people, and you people who are used to a district, say, being a certain way for 10 years, you're going to have people who are going to react one way or the other. And that, to us, is something that we understand, and we're trying to modify, you know, based on the preliminary plans, the feedback that we got from the communities. And so there are a number of districts that didn't like the way the maps impacted their particular area. And we took that very seriously.
Yeah. And we should make it very, very clear that part of the reason we're talking today is because you have new draft maps coming out on Thursday.
That is correct.
That's a big deal. I think people will have a lot of people will be waiting with bated breath to see those new maps. But before we get to that, I want to talk about some of the feedback that you got about the drafts. The first set of drafts you released in July, people had some thoughts, as you said. And
I would say it a little stronger than thoughts, but you can put it nicely and say thoughts. I mean, people had, I mean, and understandably so, some very hardcore reactions to the maps that we put out.
And some of those folks included current city council incumbents, council members Justin Brannon and Alexa Aviles, who are neighboring districts in South Brooklyn, issued a joint statement criticizing the first draft since it put them in the same district. They would have had, they could potentially be facing a primary challenge against each other. They're both Democrats. And also, they say it split the Latino communities in Sunset Park and Red Hook. What has the commission done with their input?
So it's a great question, because not necessarily for the letters that they sent, which we definitely factored in, but it also points out the role that the current incumbents play, because some of them in the beginning didn't think they could even testify. And one of the things we wanted to encourage is that they're citizens, they're part of New York City, and we wanted that feedback. And so their feedback, along with feedback from other city council members, along with citizens who are not elected officials, were taken in by us and analyzed. And we analyzed the people who came. So, for example, the council members that you referred to, one came to but didn't testify, one came to and testified at, I think, our Brooklyn meeting at Mega Rivers College. So we've had elected officials, council members, and other representatives come to our borough hearings to testify. And that's part of their role, and we encourage that.
Sure.
But at the same time, we have not been, at least I can say with me, and I know others, individually lobbied by them as far as we want this, we want that. And so for me, it's a, you know, I thought about this not just in preparing for the show, but just in general, as far as the next step that you're talking about when it comes to the 22nd of September. You know, the majority, a good portion of the new city council members, you know, I don't know, aside from seeing on television, and that helps tremendously, because you're not really locked into that zone of who's a Democrat, who's a Republican, even though you know the city is majority Democrat and all that, but you don't know where they're represented. And obviously we're going to do research, but that helps really to keep you pure in the drawing of the maps and factoring in the new populations that I talked about earlier. And it's such a complex, detailed process. You can't let the gerrymandering and the competition issue or any other issue flow, but you also have to be sensitive to the feedback of individuals. And those are the balls that we're juggling.
So I want to bring in a caller. We have Teresa from Clinton and Hell's Kitchen. Teresa, welcome to the People's Guide to Power in WNYC. What is your question or comment about redistricting?
Good morning, and thank you for having thank you for having this show. It's very important. My question to Mr. Walcott is, we in Hell's Kitchen have a special district, which is five stories. Things can't be built above five stories. And that's part of the Clinton Special District and the Hell's Kitchen Special District. Since the district only extends for 20 blocks from north to south, give or take, and then from, I believe it's 8th Avenue to 11th Avenue, it seems to be that they want to split the entire district up into three separate council districts, which really smacks of the naked greed of developers who are just licking their chops to build higher, you know, skyscrapers as they did down by Hudson Yards and as they have done above 59th Street, and destroy the density of the district. And that is a one-way trip to insanity.
So it sounds like you're concerned about that proposed split of your special district into three districts. Dennis, can you, you know, sure. We know these new drafts. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, Bridget. I just wanted to, sorry to interrupt you, but with Hell's Kitchen, as well as other districts throughout the city, we heard people. I can tell you that the Hell's Kitchen representation, community representation, and political representation came out to the Schomburg to voice basically what this caller said. And, you know, you can pinpoint the various communities and the public meetings they actually attended to voice those concerns. And the local council member of Hell's Kitchen, along with the community members, were there. And I would say to the caller and others throughout the city, you know, wait until the 22nd of September when we'll be releasing the next maps. The next level of maps that we are putting out based on the feedback. And then I don't want to lose this part of it, Bridget, because I think it's important that even after the 22nd, it does not end there. Mm. It's just from a process point of view, the council then will get what we submit to them, and then they will review it, either accept it or send it back to us with their remarks of what their concerns are and give us the feedback as far as their views. And then we, the commission, then we'll have to take this to the next level, again, doing public hearings. But our goal is to, at the end of the day, if the council does not accept it, to have something back to the city clerk by the 7th of February of 2023. And that allows the new districts to be in place and those who want to run the time for petitioning moving forward for the new elections. So again, there are specific timelines and guidelines that we have to follow, which I think hopefully avoids the issues that surfaced before, hopefully prevents any litigation. But the most important thing is saying to the community that, you know, we tried to factor in their feedback, but also accepting the reality that, again, with 630,000 people, 5% deviation, all the pieces that we have to adhere to from the law, from the charter, from the Voting Rights Act, and making sure that certain districts maintain their percentages, it's a complex process. And we know, at least I know, that this is not going to be a popularity contest, and there will always be people who have feedback as far as what they see in the next round. Sure. On the 22nd.
So, Dennis, two quick questions, because I know you got to go. I want to clarify just to make sure that I heard you correctly. So my understanding was the deadline that the city commission is striving for is to get these new maps to the city clerk by December 7th of this year, because all these council members have to run for re-election next year, correct?
Correct, but I thought it was February 7th. We can clarify that date, but I think it's February 7th, knowing that that's the end deadline. And so we definitely have to make sure they're in place and certified so that way they can do the petitioning next year. Great. For races in next year.
And then final question, I've heard a little rumbling about this, but is there a chance the commission may increase the number of city council seats? We currently have 51. Given all of the needs of all these different communities, is increasing the numbers of seats a way to, you know, potentially keep power in certain places and ensure that other communities that maybe have not been represented feel like they have a representative to turn to?
You might have heard rumbling, but that is not within our purview. That is something I think has to be taken up through the city charter process itself. But New York City is growing like crazy. And one other piece, because I know a number of people had testified to this as well, that their communities are growing and it wasn't reflected in the census. Mm. But the reality is our cutoff is the census data, no matter how one views the census data. And that then really is what we have to work with. So the growth that has continued to occur in New York City beyond the census will not be reflected in this, but it's not within our purview to create. So we have to fit all of these components in the existing 51 city council districts.
We're going to have to leave it there for now. Thank you to Dennis Walcott, chair of the New York City Districting Commission, someone who's done lots of different things in New York City. We are so, so grateful that you could join us.
Thank you, Bridget, and thank you for having me.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the People's Guide to Power, our new midterm election pop-up show. Thanks for joining us here in week two. I'm Bridget Bergen. My next guest is part of a coalition that has come up with an alternative map for these council districts that they say does a better job of bringing representation to more New Yorkers, and particularly Black, Latino, and Asian voters. Jerry Vadamala is Democracy Program Director at the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Jerry, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And Jerry, you are part of a group called the Unity Coalition. Can you just tell us briefly what that is?
Yeah, it's the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, also known as ALDEF, Latino Justice, formerly known as PERLDEF, the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, and the Center for Law and Social Justice at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn. We represent the Asian, Latino, and Black communities respectively. And we've done this for several decades now, where we come together and submit one joint map. It's one proposal from all of our groups that we feel complies with the Voting Rights Act and all local requirements and federal requirements. So in this case, the city charter. We did release unity maps for state assembly, for state senate, for congressional, and now we're doing it again for city council.
I said earlier in the show that some people say badly drawn districts function as a form of voter suppression. You are one of those people who has said that to me. Can you describe what that means?
Yeah, and you know, I say it's actually the most effective voter suppression tool out there. Because if your community is divided into several different districts, I'll give you some examples. One really terrible example is Richmond Hill, South Ozone Park. At almost every legislative level, this community, this neighborhood, is divided into numerous different districts. So since there's such a small piece of several different districts, maybe 5% or 10% of several different districts, when there's a problem and they need a response from elected officials, every single one of them will say, well, you're only a small piece of my district, go to the other person. Hmm. And the reason, so you have a lack of response from elected officials, but you can never get somebody from your community elected. Since you're divided so much, if you're all, you know, on board, you got everybody involved and everybody wants to vote for one candidate, they can't because that community is divided into five or six different districts. It's impossible, even if they all come out to vote and cast the ballot, it can't be for that same candidate, and they're unable to elect a candidate of their choice. It's voter suppression.
Just a reminder, we're talking with Jerry Vadamala, the Democracy Program Director at the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund. I'm Bridget Bergen, and this is The People's Guide to Power. Jerry, we obviously can't talk about the boundaries of all 51 districts. And, you know, listeners, just a tip, there is a great website called Redistricting in You, developed by the CUNY Mapping Service Center at the CUNY Graduate Center. Steve Romaluski and his team set up this really cool tool that will let you see these proposed districts, where you live, the demographics. So Redistricting You, Google it. It's very helpful. But Jerry, what are one or two of the things that you think the Unity map does to improve on the commission's draft maps?
Well, so I just want to be clear. We didn't start with the commission's draft plan and try to improve it. You know, we came up with our own plan at the start of the process. And, you know, there's a lot of troubling things about the commission's plan, but I'll tell you, some of the things that really stand out is dismantling performing coalition districts. What do I mean by that? That's a district where you have two or more communities of color that are protected under the Federal Voting Rights Act. For example, I'll look at City Council District 38. That is in Sunset Park. It is a community that is mostly Latino and Asian, and together they're over 50% of the district. And together they elect a candidate of their choice. That's what we mean by performing.
Mm-hmm.
So together, this is a performing coalition district. And what happened in the commission's plan? They dismantled that performing coalition district, removed the Latino portion from Red Hook, and made it a plurality white district, despite white population laws. So you go from a performing coalition district to now having a white plurality district, putting the rest of Sunset Park, the Latino portion, with Bay Ridge. Similar thing happened in 26, City Council District 26. This is the first Korean American elected to City Council, along with District 23. They both were elected. First Koreans elected to City Council. City Council District 26, they did the same thing. This is a plurality Asian district. Together with Latinos, it's a majority, so it's a coalition district. They dismantled that district, took Woodside out, put parts of Woodside with Maspeth. I mean, people that know the city, Woodside has nothing in common with Maspeth, and now made that a plurality white district by putting Upper East Side into District 26. I mean, these things, when you look at the numbers, the white population in Queens decreased by 30%, and the Asian population increased by 29%, completely opposite directions. So how do you get from a plurality Asian district that's electing an Asian American, dismantling that coalition district and making a plurality white district? I mean, these are things that they look like they're violating the city charter, because the city charter has a prioritized list that you have to follow. And number two on that list is making sure there's fair and effective representation for language and racial minorities protecting the Federal Voting Rights Act. So, you know, I think one big change that we have also is we finally, I mentioned earlier, Richmond Hill South Ozone Park. We were able to have a opportunity district for that community, finally keeping them whole, mostly whole, as much as we could with Ozone Park in City Council District 32. It becomes a plurality Asian district, and for the first time finally allows them to elect a candidate of their choice while maintaining the three other majority black districts that are there, the districts 27, 28, and 31.
I want to go to another caller. We've got Karen in Kips Bay. Karen, welcome to WNYC. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. My name's Karen Lee, and I am the executive director of the Neighborhood Association in Kips Bay. Kips Bay is in the very northern part of Council District 2, which kind of stretches up from the Lower East Side all the way up to Midtown. And the people in my district have not felt represented for about two decades. And that's how long I've been here. So we have responded to the current maps. We've drawn our own idea of, you know, squaring off the District 2 and District 4 maps so that they make more sense and that they're more contiguous. But our question is, how do we really get this heard? We don't feel as though we have much of a voice. So,
Karen, thanks so much. Jerry, you certainly have worked hard to make sure that the Unity map is seen and heard. Do you have some advice for Karen?
Yeah, I mean, redistricting is very difficult. There's so many different entities depending on which legislative level you're at. I mean, this is a districting commission. We know there's 15 members there. It's really hard, and this is a complaint all of us have, to know who's actually making the decisions. Who's actually making the decisions on what the lines are? But one of the things you can do as a member of the public is be as vocal as you can in the public hearings and trying to get press involved. So, Bridget, thank you for bringing attention to this this issue. But, I mean, that's our outside strategy. That's what we try our best to do, is get the media involved, bring attention to some of the districts that are really in bad shape, that are dividing neighborhoods, have rallies. We just had a rally in Richmond Hill, South Ozone Park, last week, trying our best to get attention and put that public pressure on the commission. That's really the most you can do. If you have some kind of inside access to folks, then you're in better shape than most of us, because most of us don't have that access. And we have to resort to just our public comments at the hearings and hopefully getting the media involved and doing things like rallies and bringing as much attention as you can to it in the media.
Karen, thanks so much for calling, and please call us again. Jerry, new maps coming Thursday. What's the first thing you're going to be looking for?
First thing we do, so we identified 16 different Asian American, what we call communities of interest. And they're not, you know, these are neighborhoods that have a substantial portion of Asian American voters. We had mapped those out, and I encourage everybody here, you know, if you're interested in redistricting, one of the first things you do is you map out your neighborhood. What I mean by that is, you know, let's say you live in Flushing. I'd say, okay, what's the northern boundary, eastern, southern, western, down to the street, right? You have to actually map it out. And there's these great software tools out there that you can do that now with. One of them is called Representable. That's one of the ones I like. It's very user-friendly. You can click on and with the census blocks and map out your neighborhood. We have those mapped out. We submitted to the Districting Commission. We're going to superimpose those communities of interest over the new proposal, the new lines. And it's a very simple process. We're going to see, did they divide our communities or not? The more whole our communities are kept, the more support we'll have for the proposal. And we did the same thing with our own plan, with the Unity Map. And that's our goal. I think everybody that's involved in redistricting, that's what they want, to keep their community whole and not divided. Mm-hmm. So that's what the first thing we're going to do is that analysis to see if they've kept us whole or if they divided us again.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there for now. It's a good note to leave that on. And Jerry, I'm sure we will be talking in the coming weeks when we do see those final maps or those next draft maps. Thank you so much, Jerry Vadamala, Democracy Program Director at the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund and a leader in the Unity Map Coalition. It's going to be an exciting week. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to The People's Guide to Power. It's week two of our new pop-up elections call-in show. I'm Bridget Bergen. And joining me now are two reporters who have been covering how redistricting changes the political dynamics for voters and candidates. Emily Noh is a political reporter at Spectrum New York One, and Ben Max is the executive editor at Gotham Gazette and host of the Max Politics podcast. Happy Sunday, friends. Thanks so much for being here.
Happy Sunday. Glad to be on with you both.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Bridget. Hi, Emily.
Emily, you, I think, literally spent your summer racing around the 10th Congressional District in Brooklyn and Manhattan and the 12th Congressional District in Manhattan. How did voters talk to you about what they felt about the new district lines in those races and really the whole process itself?
So I would generalize that voters, particularly in those two newly created congressional districts, were confused. Even those who are fairly plugged in follow local politics at a rapid clip, follow local news media coverage. They had to keep track of when the primaries were, of who the candidates were, who was dropping out, whether they were still in the congressional district they were formerly in. So even for the most connected voters, there was confusion. It was a chaotic scene, and it's hard to believe the summer's over. I really can't process that part of it, but I can tell you, and probably speak for you and Ben as well, that I spent a good portion of the year using that sliding tool on the redistricting NU website to check how these various state senate and congressional districts have changed.
Absolutely. And another hat tip to Steve Romulewski and the redistricting NU team, because I think it's one of the tabs that is kind of permanently up on my computer as I look at different districts. Ben, your team over at Gotham Gazette has really been all over the mechanics of redistricting at all levels. We've been talking particularly on the show about the new city council lines, the new drafts we're going to see on Thursday. Is there anything specific that you're going to be looking for?
I think you covered a lot of it with Dennis Walcott, chair of the city's districting commission, in terms of trying to see where all this public feedback leads them in the new maps. There were obviously the preliminary maps. They had to make many challenging decisions. This is an extremely hard process. And then they got lots of feedback, including criticism in a number of areas that you've brought up on the show so far. And so I think Just to name a couple of things. Number one, one of the big anchoring decisions of the commission was keeping the three city council districts on Staten Island whole and not combining any one district with what likely would have been parts of Brooklyn, like we've seen at other levels of government for a Staten Island-Brooklyn district. So they made that decision and kept those districts somewhat smaller, and that affected a lot of other things. So will they stick with that decision? And then this Asian Opportunity District in Brooklyn that you've been speaking about on the show in detail here, what are the contours of those Brooklyn districts look like? Do they alter that plan? And you know, how does it affect the political ramifications for both communities of interest and demographic groups, and then, of course, elected officials themselves?
If you're just joining us, I'm Bridget Bergen, and this is The People's Guide to Power, Week 2. I'm speaking with Ben Max, editor of Gotham Gazette, and Emily Ngo, political reporter at New York One. You know, I want to kind of move from this conversation about redistricting to some of the other really big politics stories of the week. Among those storylines was, of course, the battle over asylum seekers, who Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, has sent to New York City because we are a sanctuary city. And adding another layer, we guarantee a right to shelter. Mayor Adams was all over the television this morning. And I want to play a clip from his appearance this morning on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
If we would have properly coordinated with the governors in these southern states and stated, let's find where the sponsors are. We have large Venezuelan communities in America. Let's coordinate in that fashion like we've done with other large communities we have in New York City, where we're able to coordinate, get sponsors, work with our non-government organizations. That is what crisis calls for. It calls for coordination. There was no coordination at all with Governor Abbott. And Governor DeSantis just wanted to use his political ploy instead of understanding that these are people, these are families, these are human beings.
And I want to apologize. I know that clip had some buzz to it, might have been a little hard to hear, but I think the real key point is that last sentence. Governor Abbott and Governor DeSantis just wanted to use this as a political ploy instead of understanding that these are people, these are families, these are human beings. Ben, what is Adams trying to do here? You know, it's obviously there's the overt politics of it all, but he also ruffled all kinds of feathers earlier this week when his office put out this statement seeming to suggest that the whole system, including the right to shelter, needed to be, quote, reassessed. He's obviously calling out the overt partisan politics going on between these Republican governors and a Democratic state, but did he clarify any of his previous statements on the local dimension?
Well, I think there's still some confusion about exactly what the Adams administration has in mind in terms of what they might want to shift related to the right of shelter. He's clarified that they are not talking about rethinking it itself, but pieces around it. My assumption, even though they're not being clear on this, and I think they're doing that on purpose because maybe they don't really know or they don't want to get involved in something that could be litigated very quickly, publicly yet, but the requirement of how quickly people need to be placed into shelter and this question of when you have a really large influx of people seeking and needing shelter, how quickly the city is responsible for getting them into some kind of shelter. There's been these violations of the consent decree around that. And I think my assumption in hearing that was that that's probably what they were referring to is the sort of expectations around the speed of sheltering people. But I also think just very quickly, you know, on the merits of just sort of government work, Mayor Adams is obviously completely correct that other governments in other states and localities should be coordinating with the place that they're sending people to. I mean, this on its face is deeply problematic here and does reek of political stunts. And at the same time, the mayor probably needs to be more clear about exactly what he's asking for from the federal government. He's being very careful not to criticize the Biden administration. But is there anything that he wants besides federal funding that he's been asking for and really does seem to need to get from the federal government?
Interesting. And Emily, what is your take, particularly on the timing of all this? I mean, obviously, we are in the post-primary season, you know, across the country. Is this just part of barreling towards the midterms?
It is. There's Mayor Adams is right to note time and again that this is absolutely a stunt and a ploy and political expediency on the part of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Texas Governor Greg Abbott. He was asked on the Sunday talk show circuit about how New York City can say it's been overwhelmed by the arrival of 11,000 migrants in the past couple months when some of these border cities are receiving thousands by the week. And he didn't answer that. He chose to pivot again to something along the soundbite you played, which is we need coordination. And that's just the reality is if the United States as a whole wants to help asylum seekers or just manage the crisis as a whole, they would need to coordinate and find where the resources are and not have buses show up early in the morning, no question and no answers as to how many people, how many buses, having to rush aid to them to meet them at Port Authority. So on the part of Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott, it's very helpful to them as the midterm season, as their elections come along. Everything else they're doing is just doing it for the sound bites so that they can get their talking points onto various outlets like Fox News.
Emily, you know, it's interesting. In New York, we've got this gubernatorial election. Governor Kathy Hochul kind of seems to be steering clear of this immigration conversation. She's, of course, running against Republican Congressman Lee Zeldin. Could she get pulled into this? I know her comments, at least on or her reaction to the questions about Adams' comments earlier this week, were pretty vague. She kind of punted it back to the local level. But this feels like it's taking on, you know, national implications.
It is. It is. And she will get pulled into this. It's something that she will have to stake out a stance on sometime soon, be that in debates against Lee Zeldin, the Republican nominee for governor, or even earlier. We had Lee Zeldin, the congressman now running for governor, and then Nicole Malliotakis running for re-election against Democrat Max Rose, stand together at Port Authority to condemn President Biden and Governor Hochul for not doing enough to secure the border. And that's one of their main arguments, almost secondary to their case that crime is rampant in the city and in the state. That's part of their platforms as well. But they might soon have new fodder to work with if Kathy Hochul and others don't at least make some sort of statement.
Ben, we have about a minute left, and Emily touched on that issue of debates. We've got this governor's race. You know, Zeldin wants 5 debates. Do you think we see Hochul and Zeldin take a stage together before the November election?
Yes, I think at least once. Only one general election debate between two candidates for governor would be something, but as far as I'm concerned, a bit of a disservice to voters. There should be at least a couple of general election debates, I would say. Governor Hochul has said she always debates, she will debate. The question is how many times, where, under what circumstances, for how long. So we're waiting on those details. And as Zeldin's been beating the drum on this, you have to expect Governor Hochul to make a decision sometime in the next few days, if not the next week, because she doesn't want to keep getting hit with these headlines of Zeldin saying, why won't you debate me?
Just to close it out, you know, we've been talking a little bit about Staten Island. During this whole congressional redistricting process, the shape of New York's 11th district was one of the storylines to watch. You know, this Staten Island seat that crosses over into Brooklyn, under the maps drawn by the state legislature, would have been a much bluer district, but the special master's district has made it more Republican leaning. Emily, you know, is this a race to watch?
It still is, if only for the implications of battleground districts across the nation. It's much less likely that Max Rose can win back his seat under these maps than the previous, which looked worse for the Republican Nicole Malliotakis. But always worth watching two figures who have been in office, are in office, duke it out, if only because it turns out to be a bit of a proxy battle for others in races nationwide.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, Emily Ngo, political reporter at New York One, and Ben Max, executive editor of Gotham Gazette and host of the Max Politics podcast. So great to have you guys here.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bridget. Loving the show.
That was this week's edition of The People's Guide to Power. If you want to hear it live, you can tune in to 93.9 FM and AM 820 WNYC or live stream it at WNYC.org every Sunday at noon through the midterm elections in November. Until next week, thanks for listening.